David Newman, welcome to Sunday Night at the TSO.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you're a first timer on this show, so I have a few get to know you questions. Are you ready?
Sure.
What's your favorite composer or composer of the moment?
I can't really say. I mean, I was brought up strictly on a classical music diet, but I grew up in the late 60s and 70s, so there was a lot of great popular music that I loved as well. And I loved musical theater as well. And I obviously loved film music as well. So I'd say my inspiration really is my father, Alfred Newman, more maybe for the whole zeitgeist of the performance and the music, which is so much the essence of film music, since most film music is a what we call a one-off. They had never thought it would ever be heard again, except in the movie. So there's one shot at it, as opposed to obviously the whole classical music project where it's a living museum where there are many, many performances of these great pieces of music. So for me, my thing that I am the most influenced by, I think, was my father and the orchestra at 20th Century Fox and that whole era of the 40s and 50s. However, it has nothing to do with the music or the era that we live in. It's just the aspiration of excellence and the incredible orchestra playing that there was in Hollywood in the 40s and 50s, which is very little known or discussed.
What is your favorite movie score other than one that you wrote yourself?
Well, I think there's a couple. I think the greatest score, one of the great scores of the 20th century is Spartacus, is Alex North, which is 1960, which is those right after the golden era. I also love my Alfred Newman score to All About Eve, though for kind of different reasons. Spartacus is a huge, giant, sprawling score where the music plays a huge part in it. All About Eve is a different animal. It's a 1950 kind of noir, social Darwinian story of the young usurping the old. It's much more of a minimalist score than Spartacus.
Well, Newman is such a familiar name in the music industry. It strikes me as the contemporary American version of the Bach family. Like, music seems to be a veritable family business. Your father, 9-time Oscar-winning composer Alfred Newman, and many others. You've got siblings, cousins, all musicians, including your cousin, yeah. Randy Newman. What was it like growing up in such a family? And was there any escaping the music business?
No, there was. We grew up in the west side of Los Angeles in the 60s, and it was pretty free and freewheeling and open and pretty counterculture and really wonderful public schools. So most of us, you know, we played sports, did theater, went to school. Of course, for us, music was absolutely essential, but it wasn't, you know, the only thing that we were doing. My dad was fairly elderly by the time he met my mother. He had been born in 1900. He died in 1970. So it was a pretty normal, in terms of the West Coast sort of beach culture of Southern California, upbringing. There was no pressure to do anything we didn't really want to do. And like I said, most of my training was classical music. I did violin really early and piano and theory and counterpoint really early and conducting. And I really wasn't interested in movies till later, nor I think my brother wasn't really, Tom wasn't really either. Randy was a generation older, so he was a little more enmeshed in it, even though he had his career, which he still has, you know, as a singer-songwriter. He lived there. Robert Hilburn, who used to be the pop music critic of the LA Times, just published a biography of Randy.
And as you mentioned, you know, you played violin and you entered musical life that way, and you studied at the University of Southern California. I'm just curious, because I know Heifetz was there then. Yeah. Did you work with him at all?
No, Heifetz and Patty Gorski were for the young prodigies. They weren't really teaching at the school. They were teaching, they had their sort of own class at very young prodigies up to, you know, teenagers, maybe into their early 20s. it really wasn't the main thing at SC. SC was just like, it was sort of like New England, or it wasn't a conservatory the same way like Juilliard was, because it was a large, sprawling, college in Southern California. But it was the best place to go do music on the West Coast, at least.
As a violinist, you played on a lot of film scoring sessions.
I did.
For John Williams included.
And Jerry Goldsmith too.
Yeah. What did you learn about film scoring from being in the orchestra?
I was more working to make a living. I was studying conducting. I did. They call it a master's degree in conducting at SC. There was a wonderful conducting pedagogue there. His name was Daniel Lewis. I don't know if you know who Larry Radcliffe was at Rice. It was kind of that. There was a guy there that wasn't like a big name conductor that was there all the time. It was a fantastic program. So I was kind of doing that, and I was working as a violinist. I played on hundreds of television and film thing. So I sort of soaked it up, and then eventually film scoring for us is kind of like a siren call. You just eventually get sucked into it because there's so many lovely, interesting things about it. I got sucked into it late in my 20s. I kind of decided that I was going to go into it. But before that, I wanted to be a conductor. I was more serious about conducting than anything. Classical music conducting, you know.
Yeah. Well, when you say that there are so many interesting things about film scoring, I'm sure there are more than you can say briefly, but is there anything that jumps out immediately that you would share with a listener about that?
The problem with film music is it intersects commerce and art. So it's kind of a bastard stepchild. People say awful things about it historically, not as much now, but you can still find very negative articles about, you know, how not good the music is. But the thing with film music is it's formalized in a different way. It's part of a larger whole, and that's film. And film is a non-organic medium that is still telling us stories like organic mediums do, like theater and opera and, you know, oratorio. And quite frankly, classical music is all organized in a abstract story structure because it's the way human beings' brains work. So the hard thing about film music is you don't know, it's hard to tell what it's doing unless you take it away from the music away from the film and look at it, and you just there's no easy way to do that. So when they're trying to analyze, they're missing a crucial component, is that looking at a film that's going to have music without any music in it.
Right.
And then putting the music in and seeing what it does to the art part of it. And just because it makes money doesn't mean that it's not art, you know?
Of course.
Richard Strauss made a fortune out of Salome, Elektra, and Der Rosenkavalier. But, you know, music is hegemonic in opera. In film, it's not. It's a more subversive art form, but it's still an art form nonetheless. There's still really good, very interesting intellectual constructs in film music, and most of it isn't, just like classical music and everything else. If you take all the classical music that was written, you know, from 1750 to, you know, when Beethoven died, 99% of it is never played. It's just a tiny little percentage of it's played. Film music hasn't really been vetted. There hasn't been a way to do any of this yet. So that's kind of the way I look at it now. It's very hard to really make a serious argumentative judgment about it without going through the process of looking at it without music to see what music actually does for a movie. So it's just beginning. I don't know if you watched Academy Awards. I think when Chris Nolan won for Oppenheimer, he said, you know, movies aren't even 100 years old yet. Mm-hmm. So if you look at Western culture as a whole thing, it's still in its infancy what it is. It just happens to make money which upsets a lot of academics.
Fair point. You are coming to Toronto to present Matilda in Concert. This is a film from 1996, the story of a, just to remind our listeners, a prodigiously gifted girl born in the wrong family, sent to a school run by an abusive tyrant who finds a sympathetic soul in her teacher, Miss Honey, as well as a very special superpower of her own. What about this film and the story continues to resonate almost 30 years later?
For me, it's like Don Quixote. Mm-hmm. She's a little child that has this terrible life, and then she meets this wonderful teacher named Miss Honey. You know, all the names are like Dickens names. You know, they're all descriptive of
Trunchbull
of the character.
And Crunch them all. Yeah.
It's fable-esque or Dickens in a way. And once she finds this, what happened to Miss Honey, what Miss Honey lost, and who the Trunchbull is, and all that, she goes on a knight errant's quest to save her lady. And she does it. And it's so wonderful that it's a little child. I don't know how it would have worked without an actor like Mara Wilson, who was such a unique presence at that point in her life. That still really resonates with me. It's very operatic. It's the fourth film I did with Danny, with DeVito. We were really in sync. Danny loves opera. I love opera. I'm an opera nut. There's a lot of classical music references in it.
It's got a really rich score supporting it that you created. Really fun. Thanks. It seems really fun, especially for the brass, I've got to say. Yeah. What was your favorite part about scoring this film? Or is there?
I think there was a part that we call the haunting. It's when she finally goes to Miss Honey's house, which the Trunchbull, as you indicated, had usurped, and scares her out of the house and basically sets in motion the whole way the film ends. It's an 8-minute sequence where she pretends to haunt the Trunchbull, who's extremely superstitious, which is set up earlier in the movie. So that's a way to get her out of the house, is to scare her off, you know?
Yeah, that would be a great chunk of film to see without the music and see how it feels.
Yeah. The thing is like a piece like that, you'd say, okay, there's hardly any dialogue in that piece. What I would say is a good example, since you bring that up, is say the beginning of the movie E.T. It starts in a star field, the camera pans down, and you see these little aliens wandering around in a woods, in, you know, near woods probably, and where they shot it in California. You hear wolf howls, and you don't know what they're doing there. You don't know if they're benevolent or if there's something evil about them. You just don't know, right? Then you put the music in, and it becomes immediately apparent that they're benevolent. And it sets the whole story up that the little creature is left there accidentally, but he's a good guy. He's not there to do harm. He's there just as a botanist or a research person. That's all done with the music, you know. Right. It could have been played with creepy or eerie music, and then you'd find out later that they're not there to do any harm or whatever. But the way Spielberg and John Williams set it up was immediately like once upon a time, but you wouldn't know unless you saw it without the music, you know.
Yeah.
When we do these shows like we're going to do, I can mute the music, so I can actually show that scene to say a film music class without the music or any of those scenes in that movie. Mm-hmm. And you can see what it feels like. And then you put the music back and you see what it feels like. And you have a reaction, which is the way we all deal with stuff. And then you can start intellectually, you know, start thinking, well, why did I react differently? What's about it? Is the music slow? Is it fast? Is it high? Is it low? Is it dark? Is it, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you can start discussing it, you know, and it's great in a group when you start trying to figure out what it's doing, because it's hard to know what it's doing without first going through the process of seeing it without the music. Anyway, that's my soapbox about this stuff. That's enough of that.
That was great. Matilda in Concert is a new project. What inspired bringing this film in particular to concert with live orchestra?
It's something that we wanted to do. I have a 35-year-old daughter. That age group sort of grew up on that movie when they were, you know, early teens, and it's kind of a cult film. And so we thought it would, you know, would be good. We want to present it as much as we can. So,
and you have a long relationship working with Danny DeVito.
Yeah, I've done 5 or 6 of his, most of his films I've done.
Yeah. What's he like as a collaborator?
Oh, he's the loveliest. Like I said, he loves opera. We both love opera. So we're really simpatico. He doesn't mind going for stuff. Putting information in the score is not something he rails against. He likes it. So he's lovely to work with. It's lovely to work with somebody that you respect that much and do, you know, many projects like John Williams does with Spielberg, or Alan Silvestri does with Zemeckis, Robert Zemeckis, that kind of thing. That's the best thing you can hope for as a film composer.
Yeah, and he's going to be narrating with the film for this performance.
There just happens to be a voiceover that goes through most of the film. So we were able to mute that, and he does that live, and we play all the music live. It's fun.
It sounds like it's going to be an absolute blast.
Yeah, it's great.
Well, we look forward very much to welcoming both of you to Toronto, and audiences, go get your tickets. Matilda in Concert at the TSO. You can find out more at tso.ca. David Newman, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it, and I hope everybody comes.